You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay loves the UW Badgers. We'll talk with him about that and sports in general in just a few moments. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last Friday, Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay gave a presentation on the UW-Madison campus titled, Why Wisconsin Must Beat Michigan to Save Humankind. So be sure to send a thank you note to the Badger football team for, you know, allowing the human race to continue flourishing with a 35-14 win. Jason Gay is a UW alum, class of 1992. In addition to making his best argument as to why humanity hangs on the shoulders of Badger football, Gay also shared personal stories and experiences about his days as a student. Before he took the stage, we talked to him about his love and loyalty for Bucky Badger and the UW. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm in the flesh, though. This is
time
amazing.
In person, yes.
Yeah.
And what is it like to be back, you know, when you come back to campus here and relive your glory days?
I feel 5,000 years old. Nothing makes you feel older than going back to your college alma mater. I mean, come on. I mean, my memories are so ancient at this point. I mean, I'm looking for just any signs of the fact that I went here. You know, there are a few places that are still open. Pipe Fitter,
right.
Still around,
yeah,
State
still
Street.
There's still a few bars, businesses, yeah.
Plaza, the Silver Dollar, some of the golden oldies are still here. But man, everyone looks so young and hip and cool, and I am not.
Now, you're going to the Badger game.
Yeah.
You're excited about it, but I understand you weren't as excited when you were actually a student.
I wasn't. I mean, and to confess, I went to school here quite a long time ago. I was class of 92. Folks who remember Badger football and Badger athletics in that sort of late 80s, early 90s window before Barry Alvarez showed up on the scene, we weren't so good. Okay, things weren't really happening. We weren't beating the Michigans of the world. So all of this is also completely foreign to me. So I have more enthusiasm for Badger mania now than I did, you know, 30 years ago.
Now, here's this weird karmic balance or something. As much as you love Wisconsin athletics, you seem to hate Michigan,
yeah,
University of Michigan.
That's just a contextual situation. So I work at the Wall Street Journal, heart of New York City, newsroom of 1,300 or so people. About 2,000 of them went to Michigan. The place is just stuffed with Wolverines. It's lousy with Wolverines. And they're also handsome and smart, and they love to remind you they went to Ann Arbor. They call it Ann Arbor, of course. They don't call it Madison. And they really sort of just, I don't know, I think they think they're superior.
Now, I don't usually like to bring myself into the story.
Got it.
But I'm going to own up here. I'm from Michigan.
Okay.
I went to school in Ann Arbor
and
then at UW-Madison.
No kidding.
What do you make of this like hybrid creature like me?
Well, have you taken a loyalty pledge? Is that an annual thing you need to do?
I'm Wisconsin now.
Okay.
I'm Packers over the Lions now, which was not a hard call.
I mean, of course, I'm being a little bit glib and silly here. I have a great many people who I respect and admire who went to Michigan. But, I mean, you can fess up here. Mm-hmm. As a college town, as a vibe, do you prefer Madison to Ann Arbor, or are we going to put you in trouble here?
I prefer Madison, but I'll say you move from one to the other, not a real culture shock.
Yeah, that's true.
They're basically... Madison's twice as big. You got lakes instead of rivers. You're in Wisconsin instead of Michigan.
Can I confess something to you? One of the big thrills I've had walking around here is looking at some of the places I used to live and being like, man, that was a real dump. I used to think it was spectacular. This amazing house. The porch is like sideways, and there's still the old couch we had 25 years ago. It's
same
unbelievable.
Couch, yeah. Now, what is it that has gotten you into college athletics as an alum? I mean, you're a sports writer. That's probably part of it. But why is it more exciting now for you, apart from it being a good team, than it was then? Why does it attach to your identity more now?
I mean, I think it's nostalgia, right? I mean, that's what a nostalgia is we sort of go out into the world and we try to grab for things that are real and important to us and, you know, find our way. We do sort of return sentimentally to things of our youth. And for me, Wisconsin has always sort of been a little bit in the forefront of my brain because a lot of my closest friends are still my old buddies from Madison. A lot of us live in the same area. I still communicate with those guys daily, several times a day. So I had that connective tissue. And yeah, I mean, I can't lie. It's fun. You know, Wisconsin is competitive. Michigan is competitive. The fact that we're in this mix is, again, still an unfamiliar feeling to me, a product of the late 80s, early 90s here. So I'm milking it for all it's worth. There's no shtick I will not drive completely into the ground here.
Talking Jason Gay, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, UW-Madison alum. We're talking about stuff related to athletics and sports and nostalgia, this and that. Now, you, in your columns, you take, so some people when they write sports, this is deadly serious.
Sure.
Stuff. You, not so much. You, as you say, you love taking shtick and running with it. talk about that combo.
I mean, look, the Wall Street Journal is this august paper that has been around for longer than 150 years. Sports is new. We're kind of been around the scene just for a handful of years. We kind of had this open road and they gave me this job and I don't think they knew what they were doing at the time. But my idea of sports is that it's entertainment, it's showbiz. Even at the most serious levels, it should be fun. It is often very goofy. The personalities are not these like reverential, like, you know, holy figures. They are just as silly as anybody else. And so if I can provide that kind of context here, I'm happy to. There are plenty of people, plenty of agencies out there, plenty of outlets to give you all the sort of image burnishing you want from sports. I'm there to maybe be a little bit of a correction on that.
Now you're a correction on that, but you don't just appreciate sports ironically. You also enjoy them. I get the impression anyway reading your work.
No, I appreciate that. And genuinely, I enjoy it.
It's not like hipster Gen X love of sports.
Yeah, but it's not a cynical thing. I'm not cynical about these games. I get moved, quite frankly, when you go to see, you know, greatness, whether it's, you know, getting to see Roger Federer in the flesh or Steph Curry or somebody spectacular in their sport who is just so sublime. I think we've sort of lost connection sometimes to all of that. We sort of think of sports as like this sort of business story and we're all getting so compartmentalized with like salary caps and machinations of rosters and things like that. But for me, the satisfaction of it, the beauty of it is still the actual in-game experience. And you can have that on your TV, too.
Have we lost that, or do you think at the core that's what keeps us coming back to whatever our sport of choice is, that love for, you know, the beauty when things just amazing things happen?
I don't think we've lost it in the moment. I think that things will happen in sports. Like, for example, to go back to tennis, Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic played close to 5-hour match in the Wimbledon final this year. You know, anybody who watched that was just completely sweating and glued to their seat. You're not talking about tennis on the day-to-day. We're much more consumed with the sort of, again, the machinations of the business of sports. You know, who's going where is certainly a lot of focus on the NFL and the NBA. We don't pay enough attention to women's sports and a whole myriad of other interesting sports. I think that it's important to sort of refocus people on that. And I think the great thing about them is sports at their best are kind of an advertisement for themselves.
You know, you have all these times a year where multiple big sports are overlapping and happening at the same time. And then there's all the other sports, I'll throw that in quotes, that you're just making the case we should pay more attention to. How do you triage it as, you know, a fan and a sports writer
yourself?
It's
a good question because, you know, you want to give the people what they want, right? You know, that's sort of what the job is. You're not supposed to just running off and doing whatever you want. The journal has been very tolerant of my sort of interest in other sports. For example, you know, I'm a big cycling fan. I've been a rider ever since I bought my first Trek at Yellow Jersey 5,000 years ago here. And I just want to, you know, communicate that passion to people. There's a big cyclocross race this weekend in Waterloo that I'm excited to go see in addition to this football game. So I think you can be multiple things. And one thing that I'm finding, and I'm curious what you think about this and if this has been your experience, that when an issue is mass, when there's just everyone's talking about something, sometimes the appropriate response is to go in another direction because you're able to sort of get that information from so many different places. You know, everyone's going to be able to tell me who won the Georgia Notre Dame game tomorrow night. Not everyone's going to be able to tell me what happened in the UCI World Championships of Road Cycling tomorrow or Sunday in, you know, in Yorkshire, England. Maybe that's our avenue. So, I mean, this is all an experiment. It could fail, but this is where I'm going with.
Yeah, we have that same kind of conversation, not so much about sports, but with items in the news.
Sure.
Do we bring something new and different to the thing everybody else is covering?
Yeah.
Or do we cover something completely different? And, you know, you do some of both.
I think you try to do a little bit of all of it, right? I mean, and the great thing I think about newspaper business is that, you know, you have good days and you have bad days and your days where you think you got it and days where you definitely didn't get it, but you get to go back and do it again. It's not some sort of grand production that these things take years and years and years. You're kind of writing that rough draft of history, that, you know, the famous cliche. And so you get to, you know, try things, try and fail.
All right, here's a thinking out loud question for you. We talk about youth sports a lot and concerns, at least in some sports, that they're focusing on the kids with potential to go on to college and pros or whatever. And you end up with everybody else having fewer opportunities, maybe leaving athletics altogether. And as adults, we don't do much sports. Do we need something like punk rock was for music, where it's like, hey, wait a minute, I don't have to leave this to the pros on the stage or on the field. I can do this myself, even if all the cameras aren't on me.
That's so interesting. I mean, is skateboarding or BMX riding the punk rock of youth sports?
You can make a case for that, because
you're in an outlier, non-sort of sanctioned event. Listen, youth sports in 2019 is as fertile a topic as we encounter. Everyone's got an opinion because they either did it or they have a child or a grandchild or multiple children that they're schlepping to practices and worried about scholarships, and they see the cost of education and things. And like a lot of things, we are in this reality distortion field because everyone thinks that, you know, little junior is capable of great things, and that might not necessarily be the case. And so that's a topic I love to dive into. Also, because I have youngsters of my own who are, you know, unquestionably going to be Olympic gold medalists.
Fair enough. And Jason, as we wrap up, you'll be back in New York soon, presumably. What are you watching for in Wisconsin from New York? Badgers, what else?
Well, I am excited to be here, and I'm always going to pay attention to everything that's happening with the Badgers. I'm very curious about what happens with Wisconsin and national politics. People are asking me on the street. They're saying, what's Wisconsin going to do? I don't know. It was very unpredictable the last time around. So, you know, I'll be watching that very closely.
Jason, it's been fun. Thanks a lot for stopping in.
Appreciate it.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, author of Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living, and a UW-Madison alum. He was here last week to give a presentation ahead of the Wisconsin-Michigan football game, which Wisconsin won, and to share stories and experiences about his time as a student. Stick around, more to come here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 7, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced plans to begin a formal impeachment inquiry of President Trump, saying he betrayed his oath of office and the nation's security in enlisting a foreign power for his own political gain. Join NPR this evening for special coverage as we look at the facts, learn the latest developments, and find out what's next. That's tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll investigate a surprising discovery found beneath the walls of Wisconsin Bar. Now, when our next guest was working to renovate his family's bar and restaurant, he found something he didn't expect, a massive mural of an ad for the circus. Turned out the poster was really old and in surprisingly great shape for its age. That was back in 2015. By 2018, the local media were reporting on the poster, and lots of outlets from further and further away became interested in the story. Ron Berger lives in Durand, and the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill has been in his family for decades. He joined us earlier this year from Durand. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Yes. Yeah, it was an interesting thing. You talk about turning life upside down. But, you know, it's still a good feel-good story, you know, versus the news. And, you know, we're getting kind of bombarded with things that aren't so pleasant. So it's still a feel-good story.
I think so, too. Now, describe what this poster looks like. Paint us a picture, if you can, of this really big circus ad.
Well, I guess he started out with what I used to, when I talked to a conservatory in Minneapolis and call up there and they asked what I found. Well, according to the historians, a 9-foot-tall, 55-foot-long, full-color, multi-sheet, woodblock cut paper lithograph circus poster from 1885.
Wow.
And then you'd get silence.
55 feet long? Did you say that?
It actually went 60 feet long, where the 5 foot on the end was lost off in a saltwater aquarium piece, unfortunately, because that was a rare thing in the 1800s to have a mobile saltwater aquarium and a, you know, menagerie and circus type of train setting.
Now, your family had been working in this building for a long time. When you started to go at this wall, you had no idea this thing was down there, right?
Well, actually, we started out in 1977 with one building. My mom had purchased an old approximately 1816 stone building right off the Chippewa River in Durand. And in 1996, we purchased the building next door to it and added a restaurant, you know, and kitchen in. And then in 2013, I want to say, my sister, you know, 2008, my sisters bought my mom out, and then 2013 or so, I bought that building next door, and it was a couple years of actually retailing. She renovated it for a kind of a secondhand store first, and our growth just got to where we could use it for a banquet room. And then the other, the secondhand store kind of, you know, it was competing with a St. Vincent de Paul's in town and stuff, and that was kind of a hard deal in a small town, so that didn't work out. We ended up, you know, having a room available to do, you know, banquet-style stuff. So my job was just to kind of put a doorway through a common wall of the buildings. There's two, well, actually two building walls, but I actually, where I cut in is a perfectly located buffalo piece charging at me when I opened up the lath and plaster, complete with snort coming out the nostrils. So it's kind of an interesting type of thing. But, you know, that wasn't so surprising. I think, you know, because the first take was, it was just a green kind of a paper that I seen the first place where I ended up cutting a buffalo's tail off. But it ended up being a grassy plain behind the buffalo. But it was the same color, so there wasn't no artwork on that right there when I initially pulled. But once I started pulling plaster off and lath, there, you know, it revealed a Native American riding behind the buffalo, and then the buffalo horn, the head, and all that stuff. And then on the bottom, Russell and Morgan Printing Company, Cincinnati, Ohio, on the bottom. Well, then I, you know, you got to figure, oh, we've got something kind of odd here. And then to try to guess that the time period, it was kind of tough. You know, you just look at the, you know, it wasn't paint, you know, but it was a kind of a strange type of paper, and the artwork, it was kind of hard to figure out right away at first. We kind of first thought maybe a Buffalo Bill show, you know, a Wild West show when we first seen it, and thinking maybe it was just like a 6 by 6 foot maybe piece there. I think the more shocking thing was when we ended up taking the electrical box covers off on, you know, into the wall, and we shine light in there, and we seen this piece went the whole length of the wall. That was kind of like take your breath away. It's like, really, what the heck is they? What were they doing? You know, what is it? And the mystique, you know, for 5-6 weeks before I think that was on Labor Day weekend, and then it was October 13th before I actually pulled all that lath and plaster off to reveal what it was.
Now, this thing's knocking on the door of 150 years old. What kind of shape is it in?
According to historians, it's remarkable shape. This is a paper outside design billboard, you know, that was stamped, you know, in layered colors also, but it was, from everybody tells me that in the know, that it was made to last only like 2 to 3 weeks maybe outside. First rainstorm, it'd soak up moisture, the glue would release, and the fibrous paper would break down and just go into the ground, so they didn't have to send a team of people back to take them down after the show. So they're specifically, supposedly designed to weather away. So the anomaly is that it survived in the kind of shape that it is. It had to be the perfect storm where they were in a process of probably, I think I got enough evidence to support in the court of law that they're building, in the process of maybe working on the foundation of building a new building next door. And they seen where the river come right at Duran there, and that was becoming the world's greatest logging river, or was the world's greatest logging river in 1885. So they were wanting to advertise the river as well as townspeople, and the train come in 1882, a block or two away, and you just looked at the area, and everything was centrally located. The, you know, the hotels, the other businesses. It was actually a hardware store that they put the poster on. So I think they were working on this masonry front saloon when the circus advertisers come into town, and they seen the wall, and they kind of stopped them in their tracks and kind of, could you please wait till after the show to build this building? You know, could we use it? Because it's a perfect location. They probably threw tickets to both property owners. And after the show, they were gung-ho to put it up. And, you know, by the way, the show was August 17th. So a dry time of year generally. So the last part of July or first part of August, you probably had the perfect weather conditions, never got wet. And then they, you know, built the building over the top of it and laughed and plastered it up for 130 some years before I carved into it.
Ron, just a few moments left. If we stop by the Corral Bar, I mean, can we see this thing now? It's up where we can take a look at it?
Oh, absolutely. We got the room. Actually, you can go on even online to or look at our website and get in the menu section. We got some different links. The Smithsonian, you know, got some pictures. There's some news stories out there that's got pictures of it, but it's nothing. You got to see it in person if you can get by. We're getting people coming from, you know, Europe, Switzerland, Germany, Australia, China. I mean, we've had a lot of people from travel from even outside the country as well as in the country, of course. They're all the same thing. They just kind of takes their breath away in the comments. They're just out of this world. You just can't imagine, it's just a time period. And I've kind of lost that freshness. And when I first, opened it up and took it, that head scratching, what year is this kind of thing,
So, well, Ron, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us.
Sure.
It's Ron Berger of Durand, Wisconsin. We talked to him about a massive old circus poster he uncovered in the restaurant that's been in his family for decades. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest has always liked dolls. When she no longer played with them herself, she started sewing them. Today, she still sews dolls, but it's taken on a whole new meaning. She's making dolls for children who don't see their physical appearances in the other dolls out there. Amy Gendrisovitz is a former pediatric oncology social worker. She hand-makes dolls for children with physical differences that we don't usually see portrayed in toy stores. Her work is called A Doll Like Me Creations. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Well, tell us about your own story. You grew up loving dolls and then you ended up making them.
Yes. So I played with dolls probably until it was socially not appropriate anymore. and this was just a natural way to keep doing it. I've sewn dolls for as long as I can remember. But in this capacity, it's been about 4 years.
All right. Talk about how you got a request for a very specific doll that got you started on this path.
So social media is kind of remarkable in this way. It's kind of one of those friend of a friend stories. So a friend of a friend knew that I could make dolls, and she had a little girl who had her leg amputated. And so she wondered if I could do a doll for her little girl. And I did, because that's a really easy thing to do. And I had never thought of it before. So I did a quick search on the internet to see what was available, and the images that you see typically of kids with differences are not only humiliating, but they're really demeaning. And so I realized this was a really underserved group of kids. So within 2 months, I had 200 doll orders.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you can't keep up with that much. That's a lot.
Right. I've never been on top of it. That's correct.
Now, talk about what it's like when you see a kid for the first time have a doll. Is maybe mind-blowing that looks like them.
So the funny thing, so out of all the dolls I've ever made, I actually have never seen a child in person get mm-hmm. one. So I really, really like pictures, and videos are... I mean, it's kind of like being a fly on the wall. Uh-huh. And some of those videos, in fact, there was one just the other day of a mom opening a doll of her son that died of cancer. And it broke me. It really, like, people ask, how do you not get attached? I don't know, because I do get attached. And watching that was just, I don't even know how to describe it. It was really... I have so much humility, mm-hmm. I think, when I see that. So I love those videos.
Can you talk about some of the different designs of dolls you've done for kids with different appearances?
So initially, those 200 orders were just for kids with limb differences, limb or hand differences. Because you look at your 10 fingers and you realize there are a million permutations of a hand. So it went very quickly into... I've never seen a doll. Could you do X, Y, or Z? And so the next request was Chinese albinism. So I think if there's some type of a difference, I've probably at this point seen it or heard about it. Just because dolls don't look like the ones, or kids, I'm sorry, kids don't look like what you see on the store shelves.
Right. And I think for people whose kids do have dolls that look like them, they might not even think about this. I never thought about this, honestly.
Right.
why is it important for kids to see toys, dolls, representation that looks like them?
So, I mean, let me just quickly tell you an interesting story. My little girl is three, and after watching a Disney princess movie, the first thing she said was, "I wish I had blonde hair and blue eyes." And if you see her, she actually does. And so it shows you how early kids internalize this standard of what they should look like. And so you look at, for example, a child of color, or you look at a child with some type of a difference, or maybe even both, and you realize that they will never see themselves on a store shelf. And that's so important. Representation is, I think that dolls can do things that we never even imagine.
Speaking of the videos, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has one up of, I think it was a 14-year-old girl. She had a hand that looked different.
Yes.
There's an unboxing video, I think they call them, online. And a very short video. I recommend people go track that down because it's very powerful.
Oh, truly. And, you know, that it happened, first of all, and second, that somebody caught it on tape. It's a very visible. If somebody says, why are dolls important, I would tell you, you've got to watch that video.
Absolutely.
That's a snapshot of why.
There might be people out there, Amy, thinking, this is awesome. How can I help? Can they help? What can they do?
Sure. So, gosh, there's a million ways that they can. I think that we all crave to do something to help other people. This is a really tangible way to help kids. And so I do have a GoFundMe, because in my mind, none of these families should have to pay for a doll like this. It should be a gift on behalf of our community that we say, look, we've done you a disservice. We really do support you, no matter what you might think or what people, you know, might say to you. We really do support you, and you have a place at the table too. So I would love for this to ideally be a gift to all kids. So that's why I started a GoFundMe. Sometimes crafters will ask if they can make a quilt for the dolls or clothes. So I'm totally open. There's actually a Cub Scout group right now sponsoring a doll. They're going to sell cookies to buy one. So there's a lot of things we can do.
Okay, out there listening, I know we have toy companies in Wisconsin. We have artists, we have designers, we have illustrators. What would you say to them, so it isn't just a volunteer effort here, to say to them to reflect the people out there of different races, with different disabilities and physical appearances?
So that's I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that's the second part of these dolls is they're front and center because we're ready for a different narrative. And the narrative needs to be, look, we're going to represent all kids, the kids that are on commercials, the kids that are in movies, the kids that you see on the toy shelves, the kids that you read about. That needs to be the narrative. And I think that we're at the point where we're hungry for a different narrative.
Amy, thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Sure, thank you.
Amy Jendrisovitz is a former pediatric oncology social worker. She handmakes dolls for children with physical differences that aren't usually reflected in commercial dolls. Her work is called Doll Like Me Creations.